Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Opioid addiction continues to be a major public health problem in the United States. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, the annual death toll due to opioid overdoses had exceeded the total number of U.S. casualties in the Vietnam War, and that's on an annual basis since 2015. The pandemic has arguably only made things worse, as rates of depression, anxiety, and loneliness have all skyrocketed. Today, we're going to take a deeper dive into addiction medicine and learn about the effective medical treatments for addiction that often are going underused. My guest is Dr. Kelly Dunn, who is the Executive Director for Clinical Treatment at Oklahoma State University's relatively new National Center for Wellness and Recovery, which was created with settlement funds from Purdue Pharma, the company that manufactured, distributed, and promoted the highly addictive opioid OxyContin. Dr. Dunn is also a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at OSU's Center for Health Sciences here in Tulsa. Kelly Dunn of the National Center for Wellness and Recovery is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Kelly Dunn, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you just tell us about the National Center for Wellness and Recovery, I guess its scope and mission.
Absolutely. So the National Center for Wellness and Recovery has a broad mission to eliminate addiction in the state and really across the nation. And we're tackling this by a few areas. One core is clinical treatment. Another is research. And we do a lot of education across the state. And last is our outreach. So combining those kind of four approaches, we're hoping to really tackle this problem in the state.
And so the National Center, I think it's gotten most of its publicity in the last couple of years with the state of Oklahoma's settlement with some of the pharmaceutical firms, particularly Purdue Pharma, which was considered culpable of promoting OxyContin perhaps beyond what it should have been used at or whatever. But actually, the roots of the center go back quite further, don't they?
Yeah, you know, I think back in around 2012 that OSU made it an institutional mission to treat addiction. They saw the trend that, you know, Oklahomans were dying from, more likely even to die from overdose than a car accident or gun violence. And so OSU decided this was important for the state that we help be the solution to this. And so they established the National Center around that time. One of the first things they did was institute an addiction medicine course in the medical school to help train doctors in this area that many doctors previously did not have a lot of understanding or training in. And it's grown over time to what we're able to do and offer. And so when the settlement came in, the settlement, they agreed to award the funds to the National Center for Wellness Recovery for the work they were already doing and to continue and strengthen the work they're doing.
So is the coursework in addiction treatment, is that required of all medical students or just a heavily encouraged elective opportunity?
It is a required course in our medical school curriculum here at Oklahoma State University. In addition, all second-year residents have to be trained in buprenorphine prescribing, which is one of the gold standard treatments for opioid use disorder. So our educational incentives are across the learning continuum.
Okay, and for listeners that aren't familiar with buprenorphine, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But you said something interesting, which is that all second-year residents are trained to use buprenorphine. Is that second-year residents regardless of their specialty, whether they're, you know, perhaps delivering babies or taking care of kids or, you know, emergency medicine? What, I mean, is that across the board?
That's across the board. Across the board.
And I suspect, is that because we see addiction in every specialty, right?
Yeah, addiction in every specialty. Everyone's kind of touching points on patients who really need to be identified and treated. And also just to understand the consequences of opioid prescribing in all specialties across the board.
So you are, one of your titles is Executive Director for Clinical Treatment at the National Center for Wellness and Recovery. I'm wondering if you could share with us what are some of the programs that you offer or how, you know, the mechanics of how it works at this point. If a listener, for example, is interested in getting treatment or has a loved one or a friend who's struggling with addiction of some kind, what are some things we should know about the center?
Absolutely. So we have a physical location here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, that provides addiction treatment, you know, from chemical dependency, such as opioids, alcohol, cannabis, but even some behavioral addiction, such as gambling. And we're here to do evaluations, see kind of what's underlying the addiction, because often it's not really a problem, it's a failed solution. So really understanding what led to that is important here at the center. And we offer gold standard treatments for the addictions themselves. And what that often looks like for certain addictions is medication. These are FDA-approved medication that have shown to have much higher success rates than treatments alone or without medication. And so we're able to educate and offer these options to patients to really be successful in their recovery.
So one question that will often come up when a clinical service is offered is, you know, do you take all kinds of insurance? And what happens for the, you know, we have unfortunate folks, many in Oklahoma, unfortunately, although with Medicaid expansion, we hope a lot of this goes away, who don't have insurance. Are you able to help those folks too?
Yeah, so here at our Tulsa location, we accept most insurances here, and we have the ability for patients to apply to some additional funding sources if they are uninsured. And so we're able to take care of that patient population. But we've partnered with locations across the state. These are generally community mental health centers or specially qualified health centers that tend to take care of patients who are underinsured or uninsured. And we're providing virtual medicine services to, I think, 11 counties and growing right now. So many Oklahomans now in our efforts in the past year can now access this gold standard treatment that they weren't previously able to access because of our partnerships and our virtual medicine initiatives.
Okay, so let's unpack that a little bit. What virtual medicine, is that accelerated by the pandemic or sort of all because of the pandemic, or were you moving in that direction anyway? Tell us a little bit more about how that works.
Yeah, about a year ago, we started really looking at what does Oklahoma need as far as treatment now that our clinic here in Tulsa was more established. And virtual medicine seemed to be the way to deliver care to these clinics across the state that were already providing really good counseling and wraparound services, but they didn't necessarily have access to the physician services and the specialty services that patients can really benefit in addiction. So we were already kind of getting the ball rolling, and then the pandemic hit and kind of accelerated that for sure across the state. So now we're able to launch this, and hopefully we'll be able to continue these efforts.
I'm curious, with the telemedicine, is it a direct service care where the patients are referred to your center, or is it a train-the-trainer model where you are providing expertise to community-based physicians or practitioners out in these 11 counties you reference?
The answer is both, but these 11 counties, it's direct care. They get to see me or an expert on my team on a monitor via telemedicine, and we coordinate with the clinic's own staff so they get to see their hometown staff, these relationships they've already developed, people that already know them, in conjunction with the expertise we're able to offer. And so that's one option many have now across the state. In addition, we have an addiction medicine echo line, which is basically, this is a teleconferencing option that physicians, PAs, nurse practitioners, counselors across the state can log in once a week. They get some information on addiction medicine. They're able to bring their own cases, their own patients, and ask an expert panel and get some consultative advice on addiction medicine for the providers that are able to treat their and want to treat their own patients.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Kelly Dunn, who's the Executive Director for Clinical Treatment at OSU's National Center for Wellness and Recovery, where she's also an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the Center for Health Sciences at OSU. And Kelly, one thing you mentioned in terms of the various types of addiction there are, chemical dependencies, you did say cannabis, which I thought was interesting because cannabis is now legal, medically speaking, in Oklahoma. And so that's got to be confusing because we tend to, alcohol is legal too, I guess. So people can, of course, be addicted to substances that are legal. But I guess I was looking for some insight on how the medical legalization of cannabis has impacted people seeking treatment for marijuana addiction, as it were, or has it just been sort of a relative constant even with the legalization?
Yeah, we're starting to see a trend up in people seeking treatment for cannabis. Often they're seeking treatment for another substance like alcohol or opioids, and they're also doing cannabis. And as we explore that, they realize more and more that cannabis is also causing them a lot of problems. And so while they may have entered our building because of another substance, they end up seeking treatment for cannabis as well.
Interesting, because there is a lot of debate about the virtues or the vices of medical cannabis and for the various reasons. But I think one of the most compelling arguments for it is sort of the harm reduction strategy. That is that people who use cannabis in lieu of opioids, which it depends how you parse some of the scientific evidence, but it tends to be less physiologically addictive, say, than opioids. Does your experience bear that out, or are you suggesting that cannabis can be just as habit-forming and just as addictive?
No, I would agree. Cannabis works on the same pleasure-reward pathway as our other substances, so it is and can be addictive, although the rates we see are probably less than opioids or methamphetamine. But I think it's about 9% of first-time cannabis users will become addicted, which is less than others, but still quite a bit of people. And the research, I don't think, is panning out on the harm reduction model. I think a lot of people are maybe even hoping that this was a solution. But it doesn't appear that cannabis is really eliminating most types of pain like we thought, or creating an opioid-sparing effect. So from what I'm reviewing of the literature, for most people, cannabis is not a solution to chronic pain long-term.
Okay, and then to go even a step further, it's not people who are looking for medical cannabis for various ailments. Your National Center is not a place for that, and I know that because the universities receive federal funding and cannabis is still illegal, federally speaking, and so neither OU nor OSU nor our hospitals, for that matter, are in the business typically of prescribing cannabis for any indication.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, and the evidence supports that. It's at the state of what it is, it's over 400 chemical entities. It's really not a good option for most people currently.
Okay. Let's turn to buprenorphine. You mentioned in our first segment about gold standard medical treatment for addiction. Tell us about buprenorphine, what it is, and how it works.
Absolutely. So buprenorphine is an FDA-approved medication for opioid use disorder, and it works on the same types of receptors that, say, other opioids like Lortab, oxycodone, heroin work on. And so what happens over time when you use opioids daily is that those receptors in your body get used to having them. And so when you stop having them, your receptors, your body gets really upset and angry. That's what causes withdrawal. And this is one reason why a lot of people can't quit opioids, because the withdrawal is extremely uncomfortable. And that's probably an understatement. So what buprenorphine does is it comes and it sits on the same receptors, and it kind of makes those receptors happy again because they're filled. But it does it in a different way than the other opioids. It activates it, but not fully, so most people don't experience that euphoric effect that is often very addicting. And it also sits very tightly. So when a patient is taking it as they're supposed to, and say, you know, they're out with friends, or in a moment of weakness, someone hands them a pill or a Lortab, those medications don't work because they can't activate those receptors that are filled with the buprenorphine. And so it provides a safety, a kind of a safety net for those who are really working on their recovery in those moments of stress or temptation. In addition, buprenorphine tends not to lower your ability to breathe. So overdosing on it is much more difficult than overdosing on our other opioids such as heroin, oxycodone, etc.
So it's both much safer, and it has that blocking effect of the euphoria-inducing other opioids. So it works pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, someone who your brain kind of learns in addiction that this substance is the most important thing to survive. And if we can transition someone to buprenorphine, their brain's no longer looking for opioids, and then they can really engage in their process of healing and recovery.
So one of the questions that always jumps out is, we have this effective treatment specifically for opioid use disorder or opioid abuse or dependency. Why isn't it more widely available?
That's a good question. One of the things I think is just the lack of education, which is why the National Center is teaching our medical students from the beginning. And in addition to having trainings across the state for physicians and prescribers to learn about buprenorphine, the second is that it requires a special training to be able to prescribe it, and so that often is an obstacle for certain prescribers to do it as well. But I think the largest thing is the stigma that's associated with this disease. And as we're learning more about it, about how the brain operates in addiction, it makes sense now that we can treat it like we treat other diseases. However, I think a lot of people still, because the symptoms of addiction are often behavioral, people just don't quite understand it, and because of that misunderstanding, it's not as sought out after as other treatments.
Huh, okay. Many of our listeners will be familiar with sort of the 12-step recovery model, and I'm wondering how that does or doesn't play a role in some of your treatment paradigms with various substances? Are there group therapies? Are there meetings, that kind of thing? Or is it strictly sort of the medication type of, as you call it, gold standard medical treatment?
Yeah, we are currently building out our psychological services to support the medical services we already provide. And so individual therapy, group therapy will launch pretty soon. The 12-step groups, such as people might be familiar with Alcohol Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, Celebrate Recovery is a 12-step model. Those are peer support groups that are available in the community, and we strongly, you know, encourage patients to try it out and see how the support they get. A lot of people are very successful with the 12-step model, and but for those who may not work for, we definitely have alternatives to that as well here at the center.
So the model that we've talked about with using buprenorphine for opioid use disorder works really well. I'm wondering, what are the, many people ask about methamphetamine addiction, which seems to be a particular problem in, you know, the sort of the middle part of the country. What are the acceptable medical treatments for methamphetamine addiction, and what's been the most, shown the most evidence for helping people overcome that addiction?
Good question. In this part of the country, that methamphetamine is particularly devastating. There are currently no FDA-approved medications for methamphetamine, although there's some smaller studies that suggest maybe some assistance. So really the primary treatment approach for this is getting the patient probably in residential treatment away from the environment where they can use. Methamphetamine works on the brain so much stronger than anything else that kind of just that separation is the first goal from the accessing it. But really looking into other mental health concerns the patient might have. Do they have depression? Do they have anxiety? What else is going on that we do have treatment for? Because often that helps the reason that they're taking the methamphetamine in the first place. Often they're self-medicating. And so if we can identify what else they're struggling with and provide solutions for those, that can enforce their recovery. But it is hard, and we're hoping to start some clinical trials here soon to help find more solutions to this problem.
You alluded to residential treatment. I've often read and sort of found clinically that some of the residential programs for addiction and recovery are pretty hard to find beds in the public sector. And of course, in the private sector, they tend to be very costly. Is that something the National Center is researching or helping with?
Yeah, you're right. And in different parts of the country, the access to residential beds varies dramatically. You know, we currently partner with other organizations that do provide residential services, but our current focus right now is really building out our outpatient treatment and supporting the residential offerings that are available in the state.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday, and I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Kelly Dunn. She is a psychiatrist and assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at Oklahoma State's Center for Health Sciences. She also serves as the executive director for clinical treatment at the relatively new National Center for Wellness and Recovery. And we're talking about models of patient care and, of course, clinical and public education that the National Center engages in, and then the research that goes on. And Kelly, I was curious about how you got interested in addiction medicine, or what your own personal journey was to mental health and psychiatry.
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, I knew I wanted to go to medical school. I just really loved the science of the body. But as I was in medical school, I started realizing how much mental health played in every field of medicine. And I realized that I even maybe cared more than some around me, and understanding how behaviors work, and just was really fascinated with that idea of not just how the body works, but how the mind works and how they work together. And so I decided to pursue psychiatry, and during my psychiatry training, I got some experience in addiction medicine, and working with the patients in recovery, I found was one of the most rewarding parts of my time during my psychiatry training. And it felt natural to pursue that and be able to, you know, pursue helping people in recovery every day. And meanwhile, at the same time, the National Center was getting started. So it kind of was right place, right time. And I find myself here being able to do something amazing every day.
That's great. You know, the title of the National Center for Wellness and Recovery, the recovery piece sounds somewhat intuitive. If you have an addiction, there is usually a recovery phase that goes on once someone is able to kind of kick over that addiction. But the wellness part of the name I was curious about, because we hear a lot about wellness through various advertisements or things like spas or corporate wellness or wellness at work. And I guess I was wondering, are there other aspects to the center that go beyond, you know, chemical addictions or drug addictions?
Yeah. So, you know, we know that promoting well-being for this state is going to be primary. And this could be preventative well-being, which will prevent addiction on the road. But just looking at the person as a whole, and again, we can treat the chemical dependency, but also behavioral addictions as well. But it's not also just about the patient. The patient's family and the community are often affected by addiction. So when we're looking at approaches and interventions and programs we want to build, we're really looking at how can we not just heal the patient, but heal the family and the community that we live in that are also been widely affected by addiction.
Kelly, have some of the numbers changed as our awareness has grown about the opioid problem in the U.S.? I mean, the latest statistics I was able to find from the National Institute of Drug Abuse or the CDC show that, you know, we lose more Americans, tens of thousands every year due to opioid use and abuse than died in the entirety of the Vietnam War. Or as you point out, in Oklahoma, there are more deaths in Oklahoma due to substance use than there are car accidents or gun violence. Have we moved the needle on that at all?
You know, I think we've done a lot of good that has started to move the needle. And then when the pandemic hit last year, I think it reversed some of our progress. So I'm optimistic that as we continue forward, we'll see the trend reverse with all of us working together. But unfortunately, that I think that pandemic had really changed some positive trends we were starting to see.
And we do read quite a bit about how the pandemic has exacerbated loneliness, isolation, you know, with good reason. I mean, because we want to be physically distanced to try to, you know, spare the spread of contagion. But, you know, some of the things we're reading show that that anxiety or depression are kind of off the charts. And so one assumes that things like, you know, different topic, but abuse or neglect have gone up as well. But in addition, addictions have. But we don't really have too much in the way of data, do we, to suggest that, I mean, you mentioned that there's been some backtracking. But do we know if rates of addiction are going up during the pandemic?
Yeah, I don't have the stats, but I did recently read an article that the numbers are starting to come in, and we are seeing at least an increase in overdoses. That is something they're able to track pretty quickly, that we did see a trend in increase in overdoses since the pandemic hit. So unfortunately, that's devastating. We're seeing, you know, a lot of deaths from this. But, you know, that's just one outcome measure, and it's how people are being affected in the more the living that's being lost as well across the board. The overdoses is just one part of that.
Right. And we've talked on this program before about the so-called deaths of despair that have been articulated, where the life expectancy in America for the first time in, you know, really in centuries has gone down because we think of these so-called deaths of despair due to substance abuse or people being out of work or you know, leading to a lifetime of bad habits, isolation, poor nutrition. And I just saw some recent data that suggests that the pandemic has had a dramatic impact on life expectancy and that life expectancy in the United States has gone down almost a full year. So we have a lot of work that still remains ahead of us. How has your work shifted during the pandemic? Is it almost all virtual now?
Yeah, we quickly, almost overnight, it felt like we went from full 100% in person to 100% virtual. And that was an adjustment. And now currently we operate at a hybrid model where I would say, you know, we're doing half and half virtual in person currently here.
How do you think that'll play out going forward? Like, you continue with a hybrid model probably indefinitely, just given the fact that the telemedicine model lets you sort of see people from so much further away?
Absolutely. You know, I'm hoping that the insurance companies and that the government will continue seeing that value and how we've been able to increase access to care to our patients through telemedicine, and that they'll continue supporting the paying for it and the laws that will support it. So we're cautiously optimistic and waiting to see that some of the changes that came out in payer sources and regulations that they will continue past the pandemic so we can continue our work. But definitely, you know, patients have transportation issues, frequently child care issues, et cetera. So being able to see them no matter where they're at across the state has really, I think, increased an opportunity to serve this population that really needs the help.
We've seen some reports about sort of rapid detoxification from, for example, opioids. Is that something that is clinically available or something you would recommend or know anything about?
If you're the rapid detoxification that I'm, the term that I'm familiar with is usually in a hospital setting, sometimes under anesthesia. That's currently not recommended for anyone. And even a short course of opioid taper that would get them off even in a week, I wouldn't recommend without a plan of continued either medication-assisted treatment like buprenorphine or naltrexone, because often people quickly return to using because their brains have been used to it for so long that getting them off in 5 days usually doesn't end well. And for the people listening, it is important to know, too, that their tolerance can change fairly quickly as well. So they'll detox or withdraw, and they'll go back to using the original amount they were using, which can often be fatal. So this puts patients in a pretty dangerous situation if they're detoxing without any plan for a long-term recovery.
Kelly, one last question. There's been a lot in the last couple of years in the news about newer treatments for mental illness in general, not specifically for addiction, but also including addiction, things like ketamine for depression, or actually psychedelics, you know, the psilocybin and mushrooms, or believe it or not, LSD. And I'm wondering, does the purview of the National Center include doing research on those substances, or is that still more in the just exclusively in the research realm?
Yeah, I think currently still in the research realm, but again, we'll be open to being the first people able to instill state-of-the-art treatment to get our patients the freedom and recovery they need. So those aren't currently offered here. I'm watching that research very closely to see if the safety measures pan out and the efficacy measures pan out. But with the current advent and the way science is advancing, I'm encouraged to see more and more options for patients to reach recovery.
Well, it's really interesting to learn about. It's the National Center for Wellness and Recovery. It's situated right here at OSU Center for Health Sciences. If you'd like to learn more, the website is easy. It's NCW Recovery. That's one word, ncwrecovery.org. And you can learn more about it, including about our guest today, Dr. Kelly Dunn, who is Executive Director for Clinical Treatment at the National Center for Wellness and Recovery. Kelly Dunn, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly Dunn is an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at OSU Center for Health Sciences. She's also the executive director for clinical treatment at the National Center for Wellness and Recovery. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.